From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Keith Maitland's documentary is about the 1966 mass shooting from the University of Texas Clock Tower. 49 people were shot by a disturbed sniper, 16 died. And there's a story in the film about a young woman coming to the aid of a victim, cut down on the mall just below the tower, wounded but not dead. And this woman ventured out, risked being shot, to help. When Maitland first screened the film in Austin, he says audiences gasped when they learned the name of the woman. Because, he says, people there didn't talk about the shooting. The rescuers and the surviving victims didn't get together and discuss or work through what had happened. And Maitland says that's part of what he wants from his film, to understand what trauma does to a person and a community. Today in the program, we're talking about Maitland's film as we continue our documentary film series. It's called Tower. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When director Keith Maitland decided he wanted to make a film about the 1966 mass shooting from the clock tower on the campus of the University of Texas in Austin, he knew he had archival footage from the time. Nothing like what you'd get today, of course, but there was some 16mm film shot on that day, about 14 minutes of the 96 minutes it took for Austin police to make their way up to the observation deck and kill the sniper who had shot 49 people, 16 died. Now, of course, there are ways of filling in the gaps and telling the story. You can use historians or cultural observers to explain what happened and talk about the meaning. You can do recreations. You can talk to the people who were there that day. Maitland wasn't interested in secondhand accounts, though. He wanted to use only the people actually involved in the story. And he did do some recreations, but he used animation. It's not the first time this has been done, but his approach, weaving the animation with the archival film and using actors to play the roles of the eyewitnesses, that's pretty unique. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on documentary film, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Next week, we're going to be screening Keith Maitland's film. It's called Tower. Today on the program, he's joining us to talk about it, and we'll give you details about the screening as we go along. Keith Maitland directed the film. He also produced the film, served as the director of both photography and art on the film, and he's joining us today. And Keith Maitland, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I guess I want to begin with the story I've heard you at least refer to, is that you grew up in Austin itself?
No, I was born in New Jersey, and my family moved to the suburbs of Dallas when I was 12.
Well, it gets me to the story that I've heard you say that it wasn't until you were in seventh grade before you heard the story of the shooting from the clock tower?
That's right. But, you know, I had just moved to Texas that summer.
Yeah.
And so every seventh grader in Texas is required to take a full year of Texas history. And I believe I learned about the tower shooting in the very first week of Texas history, because the anniversary is in August and school started in August. So I'm pretty sure it was one of my main introductions to living in Texas, which was quite a change for me.
Your teacher had sort of been there on the campus, I guess, that day?
That's right. We learned about the shooting not because it was on the statewide curriculum for Texas history, because it wasn't and it still isn't, but because my teacher was an eyewitness to the shooting. And so the very first story I ever heard associated with this event was from the perspective of an 18-year-old freshman who found herself amidst the chaos and confusion with hundreds of people running for their lives and loud noises coming from the tower. And she had this moment where she looked up at the tower and saw the barrel of the rifle over the edge of the tower observation deck. And at that point, she realized if she could see him, he could see her.
Yeah.
And she ran back inside. And that always stuck with me. That was quite a while ago when I heard that. But that moment of realization of what was happening, that's where my curiosity was born.
We'll come back to this, but why is it that it wasn't and still isn't on the curriculum for history? I mean, it seems like I've been trying to figure this out. Is it because there was a sense of shame? I mean, it hadn't been that long ago that John F. Kennedy had been also killed in Texas. You know, maybe it was a generational characteristic. We don't dwell on the past. We don't talk about tragedy. I mean, have you figured that out?
Well, no, I haven't figured it out exactly. I mean, there's two kind of questions in there. There's the question of why the university and the community of Austin didn't talk about it for so long.
Yeah.
And then there's the question of why the statewide curriculum doesn't include it. As far as the curriculum goes, I live in Texas and all curriculum is approved by the Texas legislature and, you know, educational committees. And they make a lot of decisions that I don't understand or relate to. But as far as the community and why it wasn't spoken about on campus and in our town for all these years, I do think you're right. I think it's a generational difference. I do think that there was some shame. You're absolutely right. Kennedy was killed 3 years earlier.
Yeah.
And Dallas and the state of Texas were really held responsible in a lot of ways for that tragedy. So when this happened, I think that compounded those feelings, and there were people who just wanted to move on. They wanted to, you know, forget.
There's this one of the stories that plays out in your film is this woman named Rita, who does this kind of remarkable, crazy thing. So all the shooting is going on. A woman has been shot. A pregnant woman has been shot. Her boyfriend also shot. She's alive. He's dead. She goes out onto the mall, risks her life to try to help. And it seems like this particular story, I've heard you say that this was the reason you made the film. Did I get that right?
That's right. Yeah. You know, well, like I said, I was curious about it from the time I was 12 years old. But it wasn't until 10 years ago when I read an incredible oral history, an article in the magazine Texas Monthly by Pamela Koloff, where she interviewed a couple of dozen people that were on the ground that day. And so for the first time, I saw the stories like my history teacher's story kind of illuminated. And they went beyond her, you know, kind of at distance eyewitness account. There were people that ended up in the tower confronting the sniper. There were people that had been shot. There were people who were rescuing people who'd been shot. And at the center of Pam's article is an 18-year-old pregnant woman named Claire Wilson, who she was shot and along with her boyfriend, as you mentioned, Tom, who was killed instantly. But the two of them lay there in the hot Texas sun at the center of the campus on the big exposed South Mall. And so they became a focal point for so many people who were looking from windows and behind trees. And I was intrigued by Claire's story because there's just so much loss tied up in her story as a pregnant woman with her boyfriend there. But it was a moment in the article when Claire described a redheaded co-ed emerging from the bushes, running across the open South Mall, risking her life in a very exposed spot to render aid to Claire, to ask Claire, can I help you? What can I do for you? And eventually she ended up laying down next to Claire.
Yeah.
And she remained with Claire for over an hour, completely exposed to the sniper. And her only function there was to calm and comfort her fellow classmate, someone she didn't know at all, but just someone that she saw in distress and needed to take action. And absolutely, when I read that moment in that article was the moment that I realized I needed to make a film about this, because that story was just so absolutely heroic and humane. And it was a story that I don't think I've seen before. I don't think I've seen a young woman, you know, a schoolgirl whose actions, you know, are held up and recognized for their humanity.
Here's a moment from Keith Maitland's film, Tower.
Don't worry now. We're gonna be okay.
I'm tired.
Yeah. It won't be much longer now. Don't worry.
We lay there and just talked, which was kind of wonderful because it kept me conscious. And I don't know what would have happened had I been unconscious.
I'm Where did you go to high school, Claire?
I think we tried to talk about who I was and who Tom was.
Claire, what classes are you taking this semester?
I'm taking anthropology. With Tom.
Tell me about Tom.
I think it's interesting. A lot of documentary filmmakers may have just used the people who were there. They're older, they're grayer, they are reflecting back. But it seems like by using actors and using young actors to talk, at least those, you know, contemporary to the time, you wanted to get at what, something else, something more immediate, I suppose.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I was seeking immediacy and an experiential kind of storytelling that really places audiences right there, you know, on the campus, in the moment, in 1966, with little to no answers as to what's going on, right, just like the people on the ground that day. And I recognized right away that if I had interviewed, you know, Claire today, who's a 68-year-old woman, and asked her to reflect on what it was like when she was 18, I would get a great story. And so I did do that. But then by casting a young actress, yeah, by the name of Violet Bean to play Claire, I could not only share Claire's story, but I could create an illusion of transcending time and geography. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, ideally placing the audience in 1966 and holding them there, not bouncing back and forth between the past and the present.
Which gets at a sort of a stylistic approach that you took that I want to ask you about. And I want to play another moment from the film. We're going to hear from one of the Austin police officers who was involved in fact, killing the sniper eventually. Houston McCoy is his name. He plays a really remarkable role in the film. But here's this moment early on, before he hears what's going on, because it gets at this level of detail that you include in the film that I think is really critical to the style. Here's another moment from Keith Maitland's film Tower.
I was either filling out reports or just taking it easy a little bit, listening to my radio on the country western. I do remember one song we played that morning, Waterloo. I kind of felt that after that day, well, here's Waterloo coming up for somebody.
Just the song of the day. And it seems like you've talked about that you wanted to push past the usual questions when you were talking to people. And I'm guessing like what was on the radio may have been one of them. But you've also talked about the smells being important and like the really small, intricate details about what was going on. Would you talk about that?
Sure. Well, you know, the thing is I've interviewed a lot of people like yourself, and when you interview people about a story that they have likely told before, you tend to get what I always call the barbecue version of the story. You get the version that they've told 1,000 times at, yep, the weekend barbecue. Someone says, "Oh, hey, tell that story again, Bob," and so you get these kind of bullet points that are almost inadvertently rehearsed through repetition, And so my goal as an interviewer in almost every interview I do is to try and break that spell. And so something I just started doing a long time ago, even before Tower, was to ask people, you know, kind of sense-based questions, because, yeah, our memory is so often kind of initiated by kind of offbeat sensorial reactions. A certain smell kind of wafts through the air, or a song, you know, that you hear, you know, kind of in the background, takes you back to a time and a place. And so I didn't want just the barbecue version of this story. I wanted to know, what did it really feel like to be there? And also, because I was going to be doing these recreations that were pretty meant to be detail-oriented,
yeah,
and authentic as possible, I was asking, you know, not just what did you see that day, what do you remember from that day, but what were you wearing? What had you done, you know, the night before? Who were you with? Who did you speak to afterwards? What did you smell You know, was there a smell in the air?
Yeah.
Were you hungry or full? You know, when was the last time you'd eaten? You know, and what did you hear other people say? What do you remember being, you know, overhearing?
Right.
And so through those details, not only can I paint a more authentic picture of that those moments, but it kind of breaks through that rote, codified memory, and you watch people kind of re-engage with their memory. And it's a little bit like watching somebody try and describe a dream they had, where the more they talk about it, the more it kind of slips through their fingers, but also other details emerge that may not necessarily even connect to anything. And so that's what I'm hoping to do. So that detail about Waterloo, I'm always glad when people kind of grab onto that, because two reasons. One, music is really important to me.
Yep.
And I think music immediately creates an environment and creates a perspective that people can kind of put themselves into. But beyond that, there's a little inside joke for anyone who knows Austin well, in that the city of Austin, before it was named after its founder, Stephen F. Austin, it had actually been named by its founder, Waterloo.
It's also a kind of reckoning that might be coming in the song. And what I also took from that was it gave you a sense of the flavor of the time, that there was revolution going on. I mean, for example, Claire, who gets shot, she's the pregnant woman you were mentioning earlier, she's laying there, and a man in a suit walks by her and her boyfriend, Tom, who's been shot. He doesn't know that they've been shot, but he thinks that they're involved in some kind of stunt. He's like, all right, you guys get up, which shows that this was the 60s. And that seems to be really a flavor for what was going on at the time. That seems like really important context.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that it took me a minute to wrap my head around, because what's interesting, you know, I did a ton of research in preparation for the shoot, and August of 66 in Austin, you know, what we think of as the 60s with hippies and protest movements and marches, that hadn't really hit Austin in large scale. And even when you look at the archival footage of the way students dressed at the time, there's not that big a difference between the late 50s and 1966 in Austin. It's not until 67 that you really see the style start to change. But there was, in 1966, a small and dedicated group of activists from SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. And Claire was a part of that group. She'd had a long history of activism. And yeah, it's always been her assertion that the man in the suit, as she called him, who was the first person to see her after she falls from the first gunshots, she assumes he was kind of rudely and crudely told her to get up and stop fooling around, and she always assumed that he thought she was a part of you know, a guerrilla theater or a protest of the Vietnam War. And I think that's a pretty reasonable assumption, but it's something that, as somebody born 9 years after the shooting took place, you know, I had to kind of place myself in her shoes. And it was a hard thing to wrap my head around, the idea that a guy could walk across that open mall, see two kids lying there, and think anything other than that they were in distress.
Yeah. Here's another moment, which I think reflects the sort of tenor of the time. This is Houston McCoy again. From the film.
Then I finally realized something was happening that I ain't ever seen before. I just thought there's 1,000 windows up there and 1,000 Black Panthers. A revolution. Hair just stood up on the back of my neck, and I'm gonna say I was scared. It was bigger than me.
I have to ask also, is it true that hotcakes were only 15 cents at the Chuck Wagon and that cheeseburgers were 33 cents? I paid attention to that. Like, how detailed were you?
Yeah, that was a specific detail that we tracked down. You know, we weren't able to find the Chuck Wagon
This is the cafeteria at school, by the way, I should mention.
It's basically, it's the upgrade from the cafeteria. There was a cafeteria, and then there was kind of like a coffee shop, beatnik cafe, and that was the Chuck Wagon. And we couldn't find a menu from the Chuck Wagon from 66, but we did find a menu from the Nighthawk Diner, which is right across the street. And I was pretty amazed. Yeah, 22 cents, you can get a cheeseburger, 15 cents, a hot dog. And even, you know, what drew Claire and Tom to, you know, to be out on campus that day is they left the Chuck Wagon to go put a nickel in the parking meter because that would get you an hour.
Yeah.
Yes, times have changed in many ways.
Keith Maitland is with us. He directed the documentary film Tower, which you can see next Tuesday evening. We're going to be screening it at the Rose Wagoner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Keith is going to be there for a Q&A after the film. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Monday, Monday.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the story of the country's first mass school shooting. This was in Austin, Texas, in the summer 1966. A disturbed gunman opened fire on the University of Texas campus from the school's clock tower. In a new documentary film, director Keith Maitland recreates the events of that day in a remarkably unique way through archival film and animation. Told completely by the people who experienced it, it's the latest in our documentary film series. It's called Tower. We're screening it next week, talking about it with Keith Maitland today. I want to ask you about some of the archival footage that you have and the TV and radio reporting, particularly the radio reporting that's going on. Maybe you can say something about Neil Speltz. He's a radio reporter. Was it KTBC? I'm trying to think of the call letters of the
radio
station.
That's right. Yeah. So Neil was a 29-year-old radio reporter, and he was in the KTBC office that morning. He actually wasn't and much of an on-air personality. He was the news director at the station, and he was the first to hear of the sniper on the campus. He heard about it from a police scanner. And then he called the police and got some detail. And he sent a reporter out to kind of report on it. And the initial reporter said, I'm going to head down there. And if I don't see anything, then I'll head over to the hospital to see if I can hear anything. And so shortly after that, Neil realized he wanted to get a closer look at what was going on. So he jumped into a red station wagon dubbed Red Rover. And the station wagon was equipped with a transmitter, and he drove down to campus and started broadcasting live. Like everybody in town, I think he expected he would be coming across the end of a crime, something that had happened just previously, and report on it after the fact, which is pretty typical. But instead, he found himself driving into a war zone and a very active shooting scenario.
We have a man here just came from the base of the town. What's your name, please, sir?
Leland Hammond.
Better duck down a little bit here. You were standing beside the policeman when he was shot?
Yes.
Was there just one shot fired?
He opened fire on us when he saw the policeman with his shotgun converging. The policeman was walking. He shot him through the support near the statue of Jefferson Davis.
The shots came near you at the time, though?
Oh, yeah, there were shots all around.
When he tells him to duck down, that's amazing, actually. He's right there.
He's right there, and he's doing this kind of man-on-the-street interview with law student Leland Ammons while the shooting is going on. And Neil expressed to me, he was in kind of a strange situation because on the one hand, he was reporting firsthand something he was witnessing and those around him were witnessing, but at the same time, because it lasted so long, he was struggling to come up with new ways to spread the news and to reiterate what was going on, to warn people to keep away from campus, but to inform them as to what was happening.
Here's another moment from the film. We're going to hear Claire Wilson. Let me play this and we can talk about it.
He knocked a boy off a bicycle. He shot windows out of the Texas Union. More ambulances are screaming up and down the University Drag, and the ambulances are apparently carrying those persons who we had reported as lying on the sidewalk, shot in front of the Varsity Theater and other buildings along the University Drag. The university area has been cordoned off, and so far we've had reports of people being shuttled to the hospital via ambulances from practically all the funeral homes in the city.
I didn't know at the time, but I was losing a lot of blood. I felt like I was melting. The heat was just deadly. The pavement was so hot that it was burning the backs of my legs.
This was such a surreal sort of moment. She talked about feeling like it was an invasion from outer space, how she felt like she was dissolving. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, it's something, you know, I've gotten to know Claire really well in the making of the film. And whenever we've talked about the, especially it's the 20 or so minutes before Rita comes running out to be with her, Claire is out there by herself and she can hear the sounds around her and she can hear people kind of calling out, you know, but she can't tell exactly what's happening.
Right.
She said that over and over to me. I just didn't know. She thought a number of things. She thought maybe the war in Vietnam had broken out somehow in Austin, or maybe that somebody was shooting her from above with an antimatter gun and she was dissolving into a puddle of sci-fi nothingness.
Yeah.
And, it really struck me when she said that because, you know, again, 1966 is right at the height of the Cold War, and Claire and everyone in her generation kind of grew up under the threat of atomic warfare.
Yeah.
And that was reflected in the movies of the time. As a matter of fact, the night before the shooting, I talked to several people who went and saw Invasion from Mars, which was playing at a theater on the Drag.
Wow.
Right across from campus. And so I was inspired by the visuals of Invasion from Mars and Claire's story of thinking she'd been shot by an antimatter gun to take the animation in a different direction as she describes that.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the approach you wanted for the animation. You've talked a little bit about the fact that you were inspired by Richard Linklater, who did a film, this is I think in 2001, that used a similar kind of dynamic animation approach.
Yeah. Well, you know, anyone who knows Austin and knows our arts and filmmaking scene knows that Richard Linklater, you know, is kind of the godfather of our film community there. And so he's done so many things that have impacted and inspired, you know, me and all my colleagues in Austin. But I took very specific inspiration from his film Waking Life.
Waking Life, yeah.
It's a film about dreams. And it's kind of a stream of consciousness group of monologues and conversations without a particular narrative to it. But it's a group of all different people kind of talking about dreams and existential ideation. And it's just a beautiful and great film. And it was eye-opening to me when it came out because it just showed me a medium that I hadn't considered and realized how important it is for the medium of storytelling to match the themes of the story. And that kind of loose and flowing animation style that the animators on Waking Life made use of really represented the idea of dreams, you know, quite beautifully.
Yeah.
And so, you know, all these years later, as I was thinking about making Tower, I recognized that the film is entirely about memory. You know, every word in the film comes from first-person perspectives of people who were there. But for the most part, all of these perspectives come years and years after.
Yeah.
And so it's people tapping into their memories, looking backwards, trying to remember, trying to express themselves. And something about that animation technique just really, really speaks to and honors the fuzzy nature of 50-year-old memories.
Yeah, because I guess you have to think about it that the memories are not always completely reliable. And so there is a kind of stylized impression from the animation that gives you a sense that, okay, I'm sure this happened, but maybe not exactly like that. Maybe, and I think the film conveys that. To me, it does anyway.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that, because that is, you know, I'll be the first to tell you that I recognize that memory's very fallible. Yeah. I have a hard time remembering, you know, just last week, let alone, you know, decades ago. But when it came to the facts of the day, every, you know, the film focuses on eight people, but I interviewed dozens and dozens of people who were around, and my team continues to collect stories of people who were there that day. And so anything that was a fact-based assertion from any of these characters, we were able to verify from multiple sources and from news and police accounts from the time. So I'm not worried about the accuracy of the factual details.
Right.
But as far as the perception of emotional memory, that is, you know, potentially up for grabs. And I do hope that the animation kind of conveys that we, at the minimum, understand that and accept that. And so I'm glad to hear you saw it that way, too.
We should mention, it seemed like a war, a battle. Austin Police Department didn't have the right guns. You had civilians who rushed to the campus because they were hearing this news with deer rifles. So people are shooting up at the clock tower. Massive testosterone is how I think it's Brenda Bell puts it in the film. So that gives you a sense of the kind of sense of chaos that's going on. And Brenda says this thing. I want to play this moment and I want to talk about, because it's an important theme in the film. Here's another moment from Tower.
That was the moment that separated the brave people from the scared people. I knew that there was no way that I was going to go out there and help them. I didn't want to get shot. That was the defining moment, because I realized I was a coward.
Let's talk about that. This seems like an important theme. This crucial moment. Who's going to go out there and help Claire, for example, or anybody else for that matter? Talk about that theme.
Well, you know, there is no right and wrong way to react to a crisis. And that's kind of what the film is about.
Yeah. So you're trying to cut some slack for Brenda, who thinks she's a coward.
You know, yeah. I never agree with her whenever she says it. And I've seen the film a lot of times. Yeah. And every time she says that, I want to yell out, "You did the right thing, Brenda."
Right.
You know, self-preservation is an extremely important instinct. But yeah, it's you know, like I said, the film has eight, you know, protagonists, and each one of them has their own perspective on mm-hmm. things, and they question their own perspectives. But Brenda is someone who looked at that day and she said, I realized something about myself. Yeah. And what I realized is I was a coward. Like I said, I don't consider her a coward, but I know that that decision weighed heavily on her, so much so this isn't in the film, but part of the reason I included Brenda is because after she graduated, she became a journalist, and the story of the tower shooting really dominated a lot of her perspective and her career, and she reported year in, year out after the fact on these kinds of shootings, and she would often reference her experiences, you know, on anniversaries. In real life, the real Brenda has been a great help in my research and in connecting with some of these other folks, because she had interviewed some of them through the years. But the Brenda of the movie is very much, you know, a young woman who's kind of realizing something about herself.
Yeah.
And while she's uncomfortable with it, her role as an observer in that window and someone who remembers that day in fine-tuned detail, you know, that's a role that she continued as a journalist.
This gives us a chance to talk about Art Lee. He was known as John at the time, Art Lee Snuff. He's a student. I guess he's a freshman at the time. Let me play another moment here where we hear from John Fox, Art Lee. How are we referring to him, by the way? I should ask.
Yeah. Well, his given name is John Fox, but most people know him in Austin as Art Lee Snuff. And so for the purpose of the film, we call him John Artley Fox.
Gotcha. Okay. Here's John Artley Fox. We'll hear him in this clip, and also from Brenda Bell.
Across from the main mall, there was about a dozen students there as well, all looking at the bodies laying there. And it was frustrating, I guess. Something has to be done. But if I go out there, I might die.
Thank you. hiding behind small things. A couple people seemed really dead. I've never seen a dead body. I didn't care if they bombed the tower. I just wanted a plane to come and take that guy out.
What else did you see as you came through the campus? Did you see any other injured persons? There are several people laying out on the mall at this time. Three of them may be shot, and the others may just be laying there.
A woman was lying on her back on the mall, and she was obviously pregnant and in obvious pain. It was hard to watch her and to know that no one could get to her without being shot themselves.
But Artley goes out there. He and a number, they make the decision. He still feels a sense of guilt about this, that he should have gone out sooner. But Keith Maitland, he did go out there.
Yes, and it's something that I think, you know, when you watch somebody come to this very brave decision and go out and risk their lives and rescue somebody in a very dramatic way. It's the rescue is captured on archival newsreel footage from three different angles.
That's amazing.
And you see not these kind of fleeting bits of animation running across the screen, but actual, you know, 16mm footage of a really incredibly brave moment and a harrowing moment. And then 50 years later, you see the man who risked himself to do that express, you know, profound guilt that he hadn't done more, he hadn't done it faster. You just want to reach through the screen and hug him and let him know he did more than 99% of people would. And you want to absolve him of that guilt. But as he says himself in the movie, guilt comes with things like this, strange guilt. And it's something that I learned about while I was making the film. You know, this film is as much about courage of people like Rita and Artley as it is about what it is to walk through life carrying a trauma like this and trying to overcome that trauma. And it's an amazing moment to me when Artley expresses that guilt because he's sitting across from Claire, the woman that he rescued 50 years earlier, and it's only the second time they've ever met in the modern era. And it's Claire who reaches out to him, and she grabs his hand, and she says, "Oh, Artley, you know, you've done more than you know. You know, please let go of this feeling of guilt." But I agree with him. This guilt, survivor's guilt or regret, it's something that anybody who's lived through a traumatic situation, whether it's a shooting or any number of these kind of situations, it's really common for people to carry that around.
I think I just wanted to close my eyes. I tried not to move.
Just stay still. It'll be okay, all right?
I tried to just act like I was dead so he wouldn't shoot me again. The concrete was so hot that at some point I just decided I can't take it anymore.
When I came out from under those hedges, I knew something had to be done. Someone had to go out there and get him.
I just remember looking up at the sky. It was so blue. And just thinking, I guess this is it. I guess this is the end.
From Keith Maitland's film Tower, which he directed and co-produced. Next Tuesday night, we're screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Keith Maitland is going to be there for a Q&A after the film. Seating for the show, I should mention, is limited, so you're going to need to get there early. We have details about all of it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the filmmaker Keith Maitland. We're talking about his documentary film Tower, which we're screening next Tuesday night. We'll give you some details about that a little bit later on the program. So let's talk about, I guess, the aftermath to this story. The part that we don't have really a lot of time to talk about, and I don't want to give too much away, are the sort of dramatic moments of when the Austin police, and a civilian, I should also say, when they get to the observation deck and kill the sniper. That's a pretty dramatic moment. That all plays out sort of in first person. That's pretty amazing too. But it's interesting. The film kind of shifts gears where we're hearing, you know, the young voice of young actors telling the story. And then you fold in the voices of Claire in, you know, in real time, the Claire Wilson of today. Talk about when the film shifts gears. It sort of starts to bring us a sense of the current day, I guess.
Well, you know, we started off with this idea that we were going to set the film in 1966 and create this experiential, you know, documentary experience with immediacy and with action and drama and tension and emotion. And the first step was a lot of research. The second step was starting to connect and meet with these real people. And I started with Claire, who's just, like I said, someone I've become very close with and someone whose story matters a great deal to me. And beyond Claire, you know, there's Artley, who we've talked about, and Brenda. They're the two police officers, Houston McCoy and Ramiro Martinez, the radio reporter Neil Spels, and then Alan Crum, the bookstore manager. These are all real people. They all have real perspectives. And in knowing that we were going to represent them through this animation technique that really is a step beyond the normal documentary expectation was exciting to us. But I didn't want to lose what drew me to this story in the first place, which was connecting with the greater humanity of these survivors. And so it was always by design a transition in mind. We were always going to switch from this animated 1966 story to a more conventional documentary approach that meets and confronts and lives with these characters today.
Yeah.
So that we could really get to know them, not just through their animated avatars, but who they are, who they became, and like I said, what it's like to carry this trauma with them over the course of their entire lives. So that 50 years perspective was hugely important to me. And honoring these individuals on screen as they are today was, by design, the final act of the film. And so we transition from Violet, the young actress playing 1966 Claire, to Claire today.
Mm-hmm.
And my hope is that we do a good enough job of it that people can connect the animated avatar with the real person, and that seamlessly a day or two after the screening, people forget who they were listening to at a given moment. Was that piece in archival footage? Was that piece in animation? Was that the actor talking about something, or was that the real person talking about something? But for us, the actor and the real person combined equal the character of Claire and the others over the course of that 50-year period.
Here's Houston McCoy, not the actor, young actor who plays a young Houston McCoy, Austin policeman, but the Austin McCoy who, as you say, is passed along now. But this is a really, I think, kind of extraordinary moment toward the end of your film.
If somebody would ask how you feel, well, I'd say no words. I've been asked that before. How did it make you feel? And then I kind of have to say, well, how would I describe the colors of a rainbow to a person born blind? And gay, because there ain't no words. I don't know.
You've said in some ways, and you deal with this in the film, people didn't talk about it. They didn't deal with it. The University of Texas, this is amazing, opened, I think, after one day. They cleaned up the blood, but then they wanted to move on. But it left, I think you've described it as an open wound.
That's right. I felt that feeling of that open wound in the community of Austin really as long as I've been there. I went to the University of Texas in the mid-90s, and I took a tour of campus as a freshman, and I asked about the Tower shooting. And the tour guide, she rolled her eyes and she said, you know, we're really not supposed to talk about that.
Wow.
That was the relationship that the university had with this. And in the years before I decided to make the film, I very rarely heard the story of the Tower come up. But when it did, you would see, especially in older generations, a real reticence to kind of talk about what it was like, how it felt. And, you know, unlike the Kennedy assassination, which has been kind of probed and explored from every possible angle, and the city of Dallas, who's really, you know, engaged with that history, and there's a museum and there are tours and you know, annual memorials. In Austin, this was just a dark day that many people seemed like they just wanted to put it behind them. Even that year, not only did the university just close for one day, but that year at graduation, there was no mention of the Tower shooting. In the student yearbook that year, there's no memorial. There's no list of names. There's nothing. And, you know, I'm not the type of person who's content to leave questions unanswered and to leave, you know, intriguing bits of personal history and communal history unexplored. And so as I started digging into this and as I started talking about it to people in Austin that I wanted to make a film about this, over and over I heard the same thing. Oh, my uncle was there that day. Mm. Or I had a high school teacher who was there. You know, I think the guy who works on my car maybe saved somebody's life that day. I'm not sure. And so I would start reaching out to people and talking to them. And what I discovered is that there were thousands of eyewitnesses, you know, hundreds right at the heart of the story and thousands, you know, just blocks away. And really millions that watched the story unfold on TV that day and that night, as Walter Cronkite and all the other national broadcasters shared Neil Spelce's report from Austin. And yet, being this incredibly documented moment, for some reason, something generational or something regional, the story just hadn't been told, it hadn't been explored. And that was really frustrating to me. But I realized that there was an opportunity here to bring this history out of the shadows. It was just not acceptable to let something like this get lost to time, to lose the names of the people we lost that day, to lose the opportunity to learn from this terrible tragedy. And so making the film was as much about shining a light in these dark corners as it was about connecting with Claire and the others on an individual basis. And that big open wound that I always felt and that others acknowledged as we talked about it more and more, I feel like it's finally started to have an opportunity to heal because people are talking about it now.
We're essentially out of time, but I want to get to two quick things. The film is not in any way political. It doesn't have a kind of overt commentary about gun control or anything like that. But you do include, and you referred to it earlier, a commentary from the CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite, commenting about the time. And it really helps put this one shooting into the context of the other school shootings that, of course, have happened since. You can't think about that one moment and not think about those that have happened in the years since. Walter Cronkite talks about the horror of the sick among us. And it's found in the horror of our hyper-civilization, he says, and that in some ways the shooter, whom you barely mentioned by name, by the way, I'm sure that was intentional, the shooter's crime was society's crime. What do you have to say about that, finally?
Well, you know, I looked really hard for that footage of Cronkite, and it was important to find Cronkite for two reasons. One, I think of him as the voice of the 20th century,
right.
And certainly the voice of the 60s from a news media perspective. But beyond that, Cronkite went to the University of Texas, and like me, I assumed he would have a really personal relationship to that campus. And while I went to that campus 30 years after the shooting, he was there almost 30 years before the shooting. When we finally did track down that bite, my editor, Austin Reedy, found it on YouTube, and it blew us all away because he didn't say anything overtly personal. He didn't talk about his time on the 40 acres. He talked about the state of our world and the state of our society.
Yeah.
And what he said that night, some of which you just, you know, quoted, was just as true on August 1st, 1966, 6 hours after the shooting, as it is today. And, you know, he put the blame where he believed it rests, and that was on society. It was a warning to us to look at the way we treat violence, look at the way that we raise our kids. You know, just a moment before that in the film, there's a really beautiful moment where Claire talks about the sniper.
Yeah.
And contrasting Claire's opinions on the sniper and Cronkite's opinions on this phenomenon.
You ask her if she's forgiven him.
That's right. And it's not a question I was expecting to ask in any interview. It had never even occurred to me, except it came up organically when she talked about the sniper in such humane ways.
Yeah.
And she described him as a 3-year-old boy who was innocent, you know, who turned into this 25-year-old damaged individual. Whatever conflict was going on within him that caused that terrible tragedy, it was born somewhere between a photo of him that Claire focuses on as a 3-year-old and August 1st, 66. And I think what she's saying and what Cronkite's saying, you know, perfectly encapsulate my opinion on this whole thing as well. And you're right, the film isn't overtly political, but every decision we make as a member of society and every reflection we have on society is political in some way, and that's as political as I wanted to get with this.
Keith Maitland, he directed and co-produced the documentary film Tower. Next Tuesday night, we're going to be screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Keith will be here for a Q&A after the film. I will point out again, seating for the show is limited, of course, so you want to get there early. We have details about all of it on our website, radiowest.org. Keith Maitland, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction today from Michael Havey and Adrian Moranville. David Boyle is our intern. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.